today we're going into a completely different space, because we're going to be speaking to an Asian female entrepreneur who was at the start of the IPL back in 2009, and she worked for the Reliance family, who are the owners of the Mumbai Indians, the richest family in Asia, and she's gone on to be one of the biggest and most influential CEOs in sports marketing in that influencer marketing space. I know you're going to enjoy it, so let's get into this. Hi everyone, and welcome back, or welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh, and I'm delighted to introduce my guest today. Ishvin Anand is a trailblazer in the sports marketing industry, having built OpenSponsorship.com into the world's largest marketplace, connecting brands to athletes for digital marketing campaigns. And our accolades include getting on the Forbes 30 Under 30 sports list, and including the top 100 female founders. So Ishvin Anand, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Paul, for having me.
No, it's great to have you. And I'm really excited about hearing about your journey and sharing that with everyone today. And I want to kick off the way I would start all the shows every single time we've done it. And the first question I have for you, Ishvin, is what is the definition of success?
I think it's a great question. I'm sure it changes over time in people's lives. I would say right now for me, it's to enjoy what I'm doing. And the reason why I think that's so important is because truly, if you don't enjoy it, then you can't put your 100% into it. So I'd say enjoying what you're doing.
Yeah, that's very, very succinct, very precise. And yet it's interesting, because whenever I have asked that question before, a lot of people actually start talking about more to do with their work and maybe work goals that they might have had. And yet you've gone straight into the happiness, which, you know, it's an interesting, maybe something we'll come to a little bit later on. But for you, have you always enjoyed whatever you've done then?
Obviously, definitely not always. But I would say that once you stop enjoying it, the main thing is to try and figure out what's missing and what needs to be changed. And that could be like career move, or it's like the people around you move. It's like trying to change up. You know, obviously as a CEO, my job is to kind of keep growing my team. But the way that you should do it is to look at your own weaknesses and say, okay, well, what am I not good at? Let me go out and make sure that there's complementary skill sets within the team. And so usually if you're not good at something, you don't enjoy doing it. So I'd say it's not that I don't definitely do things I don't enjoy. But over time, I'd like to think that you do less and less of those.
Yeah, because whenever you just mentioned there about being the CEO of OpenSponsorship.com, and we will talk about that, of course, about the incredible business and career that you've had already. I'm sure you will do even better going forward. But I always like to try and understand, you know, how did that happen? Because you don't kind of just wake up as a CEO of a multi-million pound business. I wonder how that, maybe that kind of journey started for you. Was it because your family were entrepreneurs, or did you see something that you thought within you that you would love to explore and try and reach your potential?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. So my parents are both doctors. Everyone in my family is like in the medical industry and fairly conservative careers, doing very well, but not so left field as I was. And I'd say like, it's not like I thought I was going to be an entrepreneur. I feel like I'm the kind of person who, when I see a problem, I enjoy fixing it. And so the start of Open Sponsorship was honestly more so in my career within sports. I felt like there was an opportunity for certain things, and no one was really doing it. And honestly, I do say if there had been a corporate job out there with the title of what I wanted to do and the job description, I mean, I would have been happy to take it. But no one was thinking about the way I was thinking about the world or the industry at that point. And so that's kind of why I set off in my journey. I suppose that does make you a little bit of an entrepreneur, because it means in your DNA is the ability to kind of take risks, take a path that's not written, and do things differently. So I suppose the traits are entrepreneurial, but it wasn't like I always thought I was going to be an entrepreneur.
But why is it that sport kind of either drew you in, or you were kind of lured towards it? Because that's the kind of your day job, and that's what you work in now. But have you always had this love of sport?
Yeah. So sport's an interesting one. When I grew up playing a lot of sports, and you know, by religion, I'm Sikh. Like, I grew up in Manchester, as I said, like, parents, doctors, fairly conservative. And, you know, I joke that, like, sports was the reason I was allowed to wear, like, a mini skirt when I was playing netball, or, like, why I, you know, went away on holidays, because it was, like, netball tours or whatever else. And so I think sports not only gave me an independent life, it also, you know, I was actually saying this weekend to some friends, like, when you have so much inequality in the world, inequity and whatever else, like, sports is one of those things that can bring people together. It doesn't matter if you speak the same language or you're from the same background, like, your everything about you is your ability on the field. And I suppose growing up, I fell into sports, and it made sure that I, you know, was never left behind socially. I was never left behind in terms of confidence levels. I was a captain of multiple sports, so, you know, it teaches you leadership and communication, all of these amazing things. And so, you know, played sports at university, and then I was a management consultant in London. And I remember that I took a week off work. Yeah, and vacation days are very precious, right? You know, when you're young, well, all the time. And I took a week of work, and I went to North London, like Finsbury, and I did a week's worth of, like, sports coaching classes. Like, I wasn't really that even bothered about being a coach. And now I look back and I think, if one of my team was to say to me, like, they took a week of work to do, like, a culinary course, I'd be like, well, do you want to be a chef? But it didn't even occur to me at that time. It was like maybe a year later where I really started thinking, like, I really want to give back to sports. And the dream with me would be to get, like, more young females, especially South Asian females, playing sports. But I kind of fell into sponsorship because someone was like, well, to get into sports, you have to learn how to, like, monetize and do some interesting business stuff. And so kind of fell into sponsorship. But it's definitely my love for sports that got me here.
But I think this is interesting whenever I listen to, you know, you starting off in your kind of early life, because I don't know if I didn't have that inequality, but maybe just it was normal for me to be able to go and join a team and go and play football every week with my friends or at school or whatever. But you're saying that wasn't normal for you, because we're talking about the inequality, and, you know, I'm hearing that your parents were both doctors, so maybe there must have been some equality there. But are you saying the inequality was the opportunities to go and try new things such as sport?
I think what it is that sports, I remember, like, when I was at junior school, so I'm like 10 years old, and if you played netball, like, as I was a captain, every morning I would get up on the Monday and, like, read the scores of what, you know, how we did the week before at the weekend. And we were a really good team, so we were often winning and stuff. And yeah, I was like this young little Indian kid. I've never cut my hair, like, big plait, geeky glasses. And because of sport, I think, you know, I've definitely seen a lot of kids get bullied over time, which is just really sad. But I think sports was one of those things where it allowed you to just be accepted regardless of, like, who you were. And I think there's something really, like, powerful. Like, I think I owe so much of my life to being good at sports, essentially.
Because I think I'm here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, it sounds like you were, you know, pretty great, bright, and you talk about whenever you went to university, and, you know, not just any university, you go to, you know, Keble College, at Oxford University. So you clearly were doing well at school, and you were doing well in sports. So almost listening to your story, I'm kind of wondering where the problem was.
No, I think it's I've seen, like, family members, like, get bullied as kids because and life is tough, right? Life is really tough as children, and being a bit different and looking a bit different and whatever else. And I know that, gosh, Paul, you're really pushing me here. I know that sports is a reason I was accepted. Like, I know when I went to Oxford, it was tough, right? Like, I was from Manchester. All of these, like, other people were from, like, down south, and I spoke differently and whatever else, right? And it was tough. And you know, first thing, obviously, I joined the netball team, and then I started playing other sports, and immediately you are accepted. And it's sad. Like, I do think it's sad that, like, well, it obviously works in every group, right? Like, if you're a, you know, thespian, you get accepted into that. If you're music, you get accepted into that. But there's obviously something about the sports culture at, like, college that's, like, different. And so, yeah, it's it's pretty deep here.
Yeah, pretty deep for first thing on a Monday morning. Yeah. but this, I suppose, you know, I hope this doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. Well, I mean, maybe a little bit of a discomfort is good as well, just to, you know, to sort of answer these questions, because, you know, you're talking about coming from up north down to Oxford, and actually was really fortunate that we spoke to a girl called Josie Rourke, who is a director, and she, you know, directed Mary, Queen of Scots with Margot Robbie and Saoirse Ronan, so incredibly successful. But again, she was from Salford, came down to Cambridge University, and again, she had that same, probably what I would call that imposter syndrome, because it was almost like, do I fit in here, you know, in Cambridge with this accent, the way I look and all the rest of it? And it sounds like you had a similar experience.
Yeah, I suppose so. You're just so different, right? Like, you know, the kids that had done like a gap year, and I'm like, wait, what? Like, you know, what does that even mean? You took a year off school kind of thing, like pre-university. And it was just, you're like different, but there's something, again, going back to sports, like there's something beautiful about once you're on the court, there's literally no difference. Like there's it's one team, and you're as good as you want to be. Like you can control that, which is, it's pretty powerful when there's a lot that you can't control in the world.
Yeah, and I think I completely understand where you come from. I like hearing why you have used sport as a reason to almost feel comfortable and feel accepted. And it is a meritocracy, and I was the same when I was a kid. You know, I was always the smallest player on the team, you know, but as soon as you step onto that football pitch, didn't matter the fact that I was six inches smaller than everyone else. If I got the ball and ran past a couple of people and scored, it really didn't matter about the height. So I completely understand where you're coming from.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Aisvin, you're talking about getting to Oxford, and of course you've had your kind of experience of using sport to almost feel accepted in your life as you were growing up. Once you've kind of graduated and come away from university, what was it that made you go down the route of the sports marketing or sponsorship that really appealed to you?
Yeah, it's actually a funny one. I think so many places, like, career advice is terrible. I think, like, across the board at most universities and everything else. And so, yeah, I didn't even realize you could work in sports, to be honest. And when I was in my role in consulting, and I started to speak to people, and I was like, look, I'm really passionate about sports. I'd love to work in it. And literally it was kind of by fluke that spoke to a few people, and I was introduced to the idea of, like, monetization in sport is pretty important, and it's quite like a good, like, base level of where you start out. So in America, that's often ticket sales. So you get all of these, like, graduates who go into, like, NBA and NFL teams to do ticket sales. Obviously, tickets is probably not as big a revenue generator in the rest of the world. So you basically have, like, media buying and selling, or you have sponsorship. So I kind of fell into sponsorship really without knowing much about it. And I thought, well, if I'm going to make one crazy change, I think I was like 24 at the time. So if I'm going to make one crazy change, why not just make two and get them all out of the way? And so I actually moved to India, and, my former boss, a guy called Jamie Stewart, had an agency. He was like a ex-professional, like, Australian cricketer, started up this agency in India. That world was, like, very new. There weren't, like, the major players out there or anything else. And so he gave me a job, and I was like, all right, let's try this out. Convinced my parents. It took me like a year to convince them to, like, actually let me go. But And then kind of off I went. And it's so funny, Paul, because I studied economics and management and I didn't even take the marketing module. Like, I was not interested in marketing at all. And then I found myself in sponsorship marketing and, yeah, obviously fell in love with it.
But and that's the thing, is I think that sometimes opportunities do just come across your path and you do find yourself, whether it was you in India or it was me as a 16-year-old, finding myself at Tottenham Hotspur in London, England, and you're suddenly thinking, this could be amazing. But of course, there are so many people who have that aspiration or desire to do well and go and make a success of themselves. So can you talk us through a little bit about your journey? Because I'm guessing you went straight into working with professional sport in India, is that right?
Yeah, like I am. I landed in Delhi day one, and I literally like took my suitcase and went straight to the office. I had like no clue what I was doing, and it was interesting. So the agency was basically split up into fashion and sports, and that week was like Delhi Fashion Week, and they were doing all the sponsorship and activation for it. So my first like week, I've just left consulting in London, I've just moved to India, and it's like Delhi Fashion Week and like parties and it was just different. And a week later after that, we got on the flight and went to Bombay. And so I was going to be like the main rep for the Mumbai Indians. That was the cricket team in the Premier in the Indian Premier League. And this is 2009, so the second season it's ever happening. My first ever meeting, so we land in Bombay, we go straight into this meeting. My first ever meeting started at like 6 p.m. and ended at like 3 a.m. in the morning in a boardroom, like not like dinners or anything else. And it was just like a different world, like such a different world and such a steep learning curve. But I think that's what makes you, right? Like that you can just embrace all of these things and just kind of park everything you know and try and pick up new things. And yeah, obviously the sports world is so soft skill based. It's all about like relationships. It's, you know, it's about keeping people happy, like checking ego, like checking your own ego, like being there for everyone, being reliable. Complete opposite of like what I was doing, where I sat at like a computer and did like Microsoft Access for like 10 hours a day. So it was interesting, amazing, challenging, eye-opening, exhilarating, all of those things all in one.
It sounds to me like it must have been really exciting as well, because, you know, I try and compare it to, you know, my life and my journey, and it sounds like almost the inception of the Premier League back in the very early 90s. And if you were there at the very inception or the second year of the IPL, you know, just even though I'm not the biggest cricket fan in the world, anyone knows about the IPL and just how huge they try to make it and obviously how well it's done. So that must have been really exciting, but you must have come across loads of challenges, both personally and professionally.
Oh my gosh, it was so crazy. So every 4 years, the election in India happens at the same time as the IPL. This was obviously the first time that it happens every 4 years. And every 4 years, they're like, oh shit, this is about to happen. Let's pick up the tournament and move it to another country. So I was in India, I'm in Bombay. I think I'm about to like work on this IPL thing in Bombay. And I remember I had a friend who was booked to come out and stay with us, stay with me and like enjoy the cricket. And about three or four weeks, I can't really remember, before the tournament happens, they're like, okay, we're moving the tournament to South Africa. Like literally just like that. And I'm like, okay, like calling my friend, I'm like, hey, not only am I not going to be here, but the cricket's not also going to be here. And so off we go to South Africa. And that was amazing, because actually, I think when you're in like a bubble like that, you get to like know people better, and like they look out for you and you look out for them and stuff. Whereas like had it been in India, there's just so much like media and people and whatever else, like you're quite far apart from everyone. So yeah, I remember there was one time that they needed my, like the team owners needed my ticket for some reason, because my ticket was earlier and I flew on. And so our team, the Mumbai Indians, is owned by the Reliance family, who are like richest family in Asia. So because they needed my plane ticket, I flew on their private jet, which was just like insane. Like Yeah, insane. And then we were like in these like back and beyonds of South Africa, because the way that the IPL was, like, they needed to be not, you can't just play in Durban and Cape Town. We were playing in like Port Elizabeth and these like tiny places. And then one time, I think we went out for one of like the cricketer's birthdays, one of the most famous in the world. And, like, the bouncer didn't know who he was. And I was like, oh, he's with me. Like, yeah, it was like really, it was beautiful and fun. Of course, it was super challenging because, you know, trying to activate sponsorship in a foreign country. And like, I was basically the only person from my agency. I've only been working sponsorship for like 3 months by this point. So I'm not going to lie, it was really challenging, but experiences that like through and through.
And I think that's probably what the nub of the whole issue here is, that Aisling, you're talking about, you've kind of been thrown into the deep end, essentially. You're there in another country. You're not really kind of au fait with the whole industry. That's the kind of understanding of your mindset and psychology I'd love to just delve into a little bit more, because not being funny, a lot of people in that scenario, instead of swimming, probably would have sunk. So how did you manage to either have the belief that you could do it or have the focus to be able to go and make something happen with all these moving parts?
I'd say I live a life of like no regrets. And so, and one is I never want to look back at anything and go, I wonder what would have happened if that, you know, if I'd done that, or like, I wish I had done that. Like, that's not my way. I'd rather fail every time than be like that. And again, back to sports, when I lived in America, I used to joke, and the Americans would never find this. It was quite funny. I wouldn't joke, actually. This was serious. I'd say, I think sports teaches you how to lose. And then Americans would usually laugh and say, no, it teaches you how to win. And I was like, well, not really. But anyway, I think I'm okay with failure. I'm really okay with asking for help. But I think the other thing is, like, when you're working with very different people or in new scenarios, I think having like a little bit of, or quite a lot of empathy is really important to try and understand where everyone's coming from. So I'll give you an example. After Mumbai Indians, so obviously the IPL season's like fairly short, my other main client, so I'd switch between Mumbai Indians and then my other client, which was formerly Hero Honda, now Hero Motor Corp, one of the largest two-wheeler manufacturer in the world, one of the largest like sports vendors in India for sure. And the head of sports there, like hard guy. And, you know, I could tell you so many stories about that, but like, I think trying to understand like where, we came back after Mumbai Indians. So I got introduced to him through my agency, and he was like, yeah, I like the way you work, like help us out. And they had just sponsored the ICC tournament, I can't remember whether it was T20 or Champions Trophy in England. So I was back in England in June, having left in March, and telling like all my friends and whatever else, like, I don't know when I'm going to be back. So it was pretty amazing to like be back in London again. And, you know, I remember there was this like day that I went, and we would like sit at the cricket and do nothing, because like, unless it was an India day, like there was not that much to do. And we literally just watched cricket for like 8 hours, which was amazing. But like this one day I went to see my old work colleagues, and I messaged him, and I was like, hey, can I come a bit later? You know, I'll miss the first hour of cricket, but like literally nothing is happening, like literally nothing. And he was like, absolutely not. And I was like, well, yeah, like, literally nothing is happening, like 1 hour. And he was like, absolutely not, like you have to be here right on time. And he was like so difficult to work. I can say all of this now because he is now like my adopted, but he is my godfather. And we have an amazing relationship to this day. Like, you know, he is literally my second father. And I'd say what has allowed me to swim is trying to understand where people come from and being really accepting of differences. He's hard-nosed, really difficult to work with. Like, will call you at 6 a.m. for a meeting at 10, like, doesn't care, no boundaries. But that's also like the Indian way. It was how he how he was brought up, what he thinks is good work ethic. And ultimately, if you live by it, it will be rewarded by loyalty and whatever else. And so I think I'm just quite an accepting person, I say.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because a lot of the conversations I've had and been very fortunate to have on the show so far is really with, you know, people who have been like, whether a quarterback in the NFL, or, you know, last time I spoke to John Amici, played in the NBA for 10 years. And, you know, these people are performing at the very, very top of their industries and competitive industries. And it's interesting because the categories that seem to keep coming out time and again are essentially the individual performance is really key, because that obviously allows them to get on that stage. But then it starts moving into teamwork. And I think as soon as you started talking about the empathy, that is something that is so key within a team. And yet I found so many people struggle with it. And I would include myself in that category as well. So where was it that this empathy came from? Is this something that you kind of naturally had within you, or have you worked on that?
I'd say it comes from trusting that people are inherently not bad. And not being, like, me personally, not being defensive. So I think it's trying to say, okay, if they're doing something, then what's, like, where's that coming from? Versus, like, expressing judgment on it. And you have, like, two types of people, right? Where it's, like, they inherently, like, okay, something happens that you don't like. You inherently think, that's not cool, I don't like you. Or you go, okay, that's not cool, but where did that come from? Because I don't believe that you're an inherently bad person. And I'd say that's where, like, empathy comes from, which is trying to understand what's causing you to do things, even if I don't agree with them. And actually, India was, like, the Indian thing was really interesting, because I grew up going to India every, like, 2 or 3 years as a child, and I absolutely hated it. Like, you know, it was, like, hot, and I had to cover up, like, I wasn't allowed to wear what I wanted to wear, and yeah, it was just like it was not fun. And then I think when I was at university, actually, and I went to India once, and I remember being like, oh wait, like, this kind of works, like, there's poverty, but they're not necessarily unhappy, and there's, like, yeah, there's dirt, but, like, that doesn't, dirt, like, dirt does not equal unhappiness. Like, what's to say who's happy and who's not happy, right? And you know, let's not feel sorry for India. Like, let's embrace the diversity of thought and people and personality and emotion and everything else. And so I think I just became quite accepting of the world. And I felt like when people who came to India, like expat friends who'd worked for, like, the Clinton Foundation or things like that, when they came to India, and if they tried to make it, like, theirs and put their judgment on it, they would hate it, because they'd be like, oh, this place sucks. And it's like, no, it doesn't. It's just different. And so I think empathy comes from a place of saying, okay, we're different, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And what my job is to try and understand what are you really thinking? Even though you're different.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And actually, when you're talking about empathy, understanding people, just being more accepting of others and probably the things around us. But I'm guessing whenever you have this quality, I would say, or characteristic or trait, that starts moving you, in my opinion anyway, starts moving you more towards the kind of the leadership role. And even though you're not, you're probably still in your mid-20s while you're in India. Did you start to see how what you were doing was going to start moving you into that leadership position further down the line?
Honestly, I don't think so. I know I was always quite driven, and I know that I was always looking for, like, I did always challenge the way things were done. I remember that, like, so we were at Mumbai Indians, and I think we had a chat with Emirates. And they were like, we don't do cricket. Like, we're doing golf and football, some other sports, but we don't do cricket. And I was like, all right, fine. And then like 2 months later, they became the sponsor of Punjab Kings 11, like another team. And I remember thinking like, that doesn't make sense. Like how, they said they didn't do cricket. When did they change? What happened there? And I was always quite like logical. And I thought like, this doesn't make sense. And like, why is sponsorship selling so hard? It's such a beautiful form of marketing. And I think I knew that I was always trying to challenge the way things were done and trying to see sense of like, well, why does it have to be done this way? Why can't we do things differently? But I don't think it was necessarily like leadership. And this, again, like, I think when I went into starting Open Sponsorship, it was to solve a problem. It was actually only over time that I was like, oh, this is not just my problem to solve. I have to make a team to solve this problem. And a lot of people talk about that transition from like entrepreneur to CEO. And it is definitely a thing. Like it's an interesting, because if you love to be an executive, you'll never be an entrepreneur. But to be a really solid entrepreneur and grow something amazing, you actually have to become a good executive.
And where does that, I suppose, where does that journey start? Does it start on the day that you started and founded Open Sponsorship? Or was it, did you have to put things in place and did you have a clear goal and vision for what you wanted it to become or how successful it has become at the minute and where you wanted to go?
Yeah, I'd say, so I think the transition is later actually, because at the beginning, you know, you know, obviously I'm not technical, so I had a technical co-founder to do everything like website wise, but like business wise, like I was the first salesperson, I'm the first marketing person, I'm the first like payroll person, I'm the first hiring manager. So you first start out being the first of everything. And I think it's different, you know, if like Touchwood, we sell this company and I do is something else, then it becomes different the second time because you raise money very quickly and you put a leadership team in straight from the get-go. But the first time entrepreneur has to be an entrepreneur first and then has to start going, okay, I need to delegate. We're not going to grow unless you have a team. You can't do everything yourself. So I think like it's important to be the entrepreneur first and then evolve that. And then Paul, remind me the second part of your question. I'm sorry.
Well, it's more just having a clear vision of what you want to do because, you know, so many people start businesses, you know, there's thousands, probably millions of businesses started every year. But the difference is most don't turn into multi-million pound businesses like yours has.
Yeah, I would say that the vision is really clear. The journey to get there has to be super flexible. Like, you know, I can give you a couple of examples. Like when we started, I wanted to do, like my background was like more in like team sponsorship, like league federation events, and a little bit with athletes. And then, you know, within the first year, what I realized is like, okay, athletes is probably the main, especially because in America, where there's so many athletes, I was like, this is where like that makes sense for us. And then within a few months, a lot of people were referring to us as like influencer marketing. And look, I have nothing against influencer marketing, but it's a very basic principle of sponsorship. Like I think sponsorship is so much bigger than just like putting a message out on Instagram and it being influencer marketing. And so I kind of resisted that. And then what I realized was, okay, all of our buyers, you know, whether we're talking to like a Walmart or a HelloFresh or whoever, like the person we're selling to is their title is influencer marketing manager. The literature that we put out that gets the most like reads and clicks is about influencer marketing. And so the vision is still there for us to be like the one-stop shop, like, you know, what I call like the match.com of sports sponsorship, somewhere that every rights holder can go and sell sponsorship and every brand can go and buy. That's still the vision. But right now I've embraced this idea that like, okay, let's be more like influencer marketing for sports because the business needs that. Like the, you know, that's what we need to talk about to get customers. And then, you know, within hopefully a year, we'll have enough money and power to talk about redefining what sponsorship means and making sponsorship accessible and whatever else. But so I'd say for anyone, I think where people maybe fail is because their vision is really clear, but they're not flexible with their journey. And it's, it's not a case of pivoting, but it's a case of embracing even the things that like don't fit into your vision and allowing them.
I think that's really impressive, Ishan, because you know, you don't have to go back too many years. And like I stopped playing in 2010. And for my kind of nearly 20-year playing career, there wasn't really anything to do with influencer marketing. There's not really those kind of individual sponsorship that probably players who were, you know, further down the scale. So obviously you would have your Michael Jordans, your David Beckhams, et cetera, would all be at the top and they would be getting the sponsorship. But you're now working with like 8,000 athletes. And that's a lot of people with a lot of brands to be able to connect them all. So I think that's probably a big degree of why you've been so successful with that agility and flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just, you know, it's just so important to listen to the market and say, okay, what does the market need today? And the market is all, you know, customers are always evolving. I mean, obviously COVID is showing that more than anything else. You know, things are changing. So I'd say like, for me, it's just about like listening, like what, you know, if my sales team doesn't hit their quota in a month, of course, like part of it is like, okay, what do you need to do? Like, we need to train you better. But part of it is like, well, why is it so difficult? What did the customer want that we didn't deliver? Like, what was missing? Is it like, you know, an interesting thing is, right, like back in the day, pre-COVID, people were very okay signing longer term contracts. COVID hit and, you know, they don't even know if they're going to keep their job. Like businesses need to be flexible. There's so much uncertainty in the world. No one wants to sign longer term contracts. So, but you can't, you know, so then what do you do? Like you increase your pricing, but reduce commitment and things like that. And so I think it's all about flexibility with an eye on your objective. Like don't lose your objective, but you need to be able to adapt for sure.
So I suppose what I want to sort of touch on now is probably going back to a little bit about, you know, that young girl growing up in Manchester and maybe some of the, whether it was issues or challenges or barriers you faced when you were growing up or for you, you use sport as a way of overcoming them. Now, as a CEO, someone who's leading the team, you know, you're doing unbelievably well. Can you give me an idea of some of the barriers or challenges that you have now in your role?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, imposter syndrome is real. Like every time, Paul, you're like, you're doing so amazingly well. I'm like, really? Still got so many things to do. So it's like, you know, you never feel like you've made it. There's always someone who's doing better than you, of course, right? Like always, you know, there's always someone who's just IPO'd or like just raised more money than you. So I think imposter syndrome is real. And like being able to enjoy the little wins is real. Again, maybe like that idea that, you know, in sports you enjoy every goal and then, you know, you still hopefully you win the game, but you do celebrate each goal and then you celebrate, you know, you also in netball like clap every time the opposing team like scores as well. And so I think there's a lot of like celebrate the win. You know, it's talked about a lot, like celebrate the little wins, the little things that help, and then move on from failure. Like, you know, it's so tough every time like you lose a client or you know, recently gave a job offer to a guy, it's all signed, everything was done, great, relax, like it's been a month process, he calls up and like gives in his notice and gets an offer from this company that the company he's with that like he can't say no to, and it's like, oh, you're so deflated and it's so tiring. So I think like trying to, you know, learn from that, but put it into proportion and say, okay, fine, it's just another day. Like, let's move on. And you know, the highs are really high and the lows are really low of being an entrepreneur. But just like trying to net stay like quite equal. Appreciating the team is really important. We're all in this together, and you know what they want matters. Like, actually, kind of going back to a bit about the empathy thing, like. Sometimes people say to me like, well, you know, what do you think about like team culture and whatever else? And I realized quite early that people are very different. And so for some people, like even benefits, for some people, what they care about is more holidays. Some people care about like retirement plans. Some people care about equity. Some people care about more money. And even like culturally, like some people want to go for drinks every night. And then some people like they want to check off at like six and never want to see their team until the next morning, never want to hear from them. And so just being able to allow people to be different and not push everyone into the same box, I'd say is really important as well.
What kind of culture would you say you have within your business?
I would say, our values that we try and live by are transparency, education, and accessibility. And so what that means, obviously, externally is like, that's what we want our platform to be. Like, we have brought transparent pricing to an industry where prior to us, like, you would have no idea how much an athlete costs. And now you can, and it's one click to get through to them, whatever else. Accessibility, obviously, because you can approach anyone. And then education, like, we really pride ourselves on being smart and like teaching people how to do it. Internally, I'd say it is similar where, if you're transparent with like, hey, this is where the business is, like, this is how we're doing. We kind of show it across the board, like engineers see how sales is doing, sales see how like what product is being built. Accessibility in terms of like, no one is off limits. Like, even when we have interns, we're like, okay, weekly, like, or not weekly, but like monthly calls with like me as CEO or like, what do you need? And then education again, like trying to smarten up. So I'd say those are like core values. But in terms of culture, I would say it's, for us, it's a lot around, ownership, like own what you're doing, take responsibility, and we'll kind of be less laissez-faire. Like, we don't like to micromanage, and especially remote working, you just can't. So extreme ownership on what you're doing, and we trust that you'll get it done.
I'd love to sort of just see what it's like in the office for a day, how you would be as a boss. You know, I would be really fascinated to see what you'd be like, almost like a kind of fly on the wall documentary. So maybe how would you describe yourself in that leadership role?
I'd say I'm passionate. Like, I'm passionate about everything I do. How would I describe myself? Passionate. So you could, like, every word has like a pro and a con. So passionate on the other side is like intense. So passionate / intense. And then I would say I'm super supportive. Like, I'm all about like, let's figure this out. So supportive on the case of, you know, a little bit, I'm always trying to find a solution. So my way with my team is like, tell me your problems and we'll find solutions. Like, you don't need to find the solution. You just need to raise the problem. I think where my biggest frustration is when things are not working and people can't say what the problem is. I think, like, I always say to anyone in my team, you have two roles. You have your job, like whatever your job is, but you also are a voice for what you're doing to me. So if you're like customer success, you're a voice of the customers. If you're like engineering, you're a voice of the product, because you can only solve problems or you can only get better if you really understand what the problem is. And I think that's where so many people like have bottlenecks when they're like, I don't know what problems I'm dealing with. Like, for example, right now we have so many athletes and we have so many brands. And one of the problems that we're dealing with, so if anyone's listening and knows the answer, please come forward. But I liken it to, we're at the prom and we have a lot of boys and lots of girls against the wall. And one of the things we're trying to do is like, how can we get more people dancing? Like, how can we improve engagement? How can we improve, you know, the matching, the deal making? Acquisition is amazing, whatever else. So I will be really transparent with my team. Like, these are the things I'm thinking about. These are the problems I'm addressing. And I want them to also do the same and bring problems to the table. Talk about your failures, like be really open with that, because if you fail, and you can move forward, you're a winner. If you fail and you can't talk about it, you'll never achieve.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Ishveen, this has probably been, you know, an incredibly successful business from the outside, at least from what I can see. You're saying, you know, we could do better. And of course, you can always have, you know, more money on the bottom line. But considering you have, you know, completely disrupted this sponsorship industry and marketing industry, because you're almost like the kind of the Airbnb or the Uber of the sports sponsorship. So where do you kind of see this going? Because in my mind, you've already been incredibly successful.
Oh gosh, so much more to do. I would say, you know, so there's kind of four things that we're working on right now. So one is growing internationally. We're mostly America based. We just hired our first team member in the UK. So really excited about what we can do internationally. And like you said, kind of Airbnb, Uber, the beauty of those platforms is like the tech works wherever you are. You just need to get the users, but the base is already there. So it's, especially English speaking countries, it's really easy for us to expand there. So that's exciting. There's a lot more to do with like athletes and brands in the US. So college is just opening up July 1st, the rules change, and you know, 465,000 college athletes will start becoming eligible for sponsorship over the next kind of year. So that's like a big thing. And we obviously are hoping to own quite a bit of that market. I want to be able to get back to, you know, that deeper vision of like being the sponsorship for everything. Like I want to do more team deals and more other types of sponsorship. You know, it kind of upsets me when I read that like any sponsorship rights kind of go wasted, because I just think it's such an amazing form of marketing. If there was a more efficient buying system, it would just benefit everyone. So I think those are kind of some of the main things like business wise that we're hoping to achieve.
And you talked about the IPO and, you know, and possibly going public. Is that something you potentially see where your business could go?
Yeah, I think it's probably more likely that we'll get acquired at some point. And, you know, I get asked a lot about that, like, when's the right time? And I think you don't really know. I'd say, because I'm pretty mission driven, at some point there might be an opportunity where being partners with someone else means that we can achieve our mission way quicker and easier than doing it alone. So that's how I kind of think about it. Like, I'd hate to get acquired for our tech and then they turn it like not into a marketplace, which does happen quite a bit. But I'd love the idea of at some point being partners with someone who can help us like scale even faster.
And I think as well, what fascinated me when you talked earlier is about almost your first time as an entrepreneur and selling that business for whatever number of millions that might be, and then going into the second time. I kind of struggle to get my head around that, because it's not something I've ever really thought of, let me go and build my first business, sell that for millions, and then go and build a second one. But that's clearly the way that your brain works.
Well, you know, it's actually a very kind of tech Silicon Valley thing. And the reason why is because you make so many mistakes your first time around. Like, oh my God, like so many mistakes. And you're acutely aware of those mistakes, right, Paul? Because in non-tech businesses, you're just like kind of growing and there's no one that's like, you know, in our world, you're like, you're supposed to raise money every X amount of times. You're supposed to grow at this rate. You're supposed to grow monthly at this rate. And so you're prescribed a lot of these things that you're supposed to do. And so when you don't hit them, you're like, oh shit, that like I did a lot of things wrong. Like so many things I you know. And so what happens is a lot of people go, okay, now I've got the playbook. I want to go build it again. Whether it's in a completely different industry. And so I don't know if I want to definitely, like, I think next time around I would want to do something a little bit more like social causes. Like I love our mission and I can't even imagine doing a company where I wasn't like 100% in on the mission. But I think sometimes, or maybe there's a way that we can incorporate more CSR into our business within, you know, the next kind of couple of years. But the reason why people think like that is because what they want to do is go out and go, okay, I've learned all this shit. Now let me go do it again, much faster, much quicker, much more successfully.
Well, if you've done it once, then I'm sure you'll be equally successful if you can do it a second time. But do you do it a third time? Do you do it a fourth time? When does it stop?
Oh, good question. I don't know, actually, when it stops. It's a very Silicon Valley mindset, I have to say. Very Silicon Valley mindset. So I don't know when it stops. I presume when you want to do something else with your life. But there's something pretty amazing about being able to bring something into the world that doesn't exist. And I can imagine it's quite an addictive feeling of creation and like change. Yeah.
So, because I think that's probably what, you know, anyone who maybe is listening to this or watching this and kind of sees you and what you're doing and how you are, or just the way that you're doing it, I'm sure a lot of people would be thinking, wow, there must be, you know, so many benefits, great achievement, but also possibly a lot of money involved in that. And I'm wondering how important money is for you in your life.
Not really. At every point, like when I moved to India, like from consulting at that point, and then I became an entrepreneur at that point. So no, I think I realize, as you get older, like there is obviously a level of money you need. And then also there's a level of like money that helps to make a difference. Like I wish I could give more to charity. Having money allows you to buy your way into certain things, which helps you professionally and personally. So I really respect that as well. Like even therapy, right? Like it's expensive, but it's valuable. I wish they could make it so much cheaper so that everyone had access to it, but like it's so valuable for you as a person. So I think like I understand that money can get you personal growth and professional growth. But in itself, I'm not money minded.
Yeah, and I think whenever you talk about the mission and how you just want to make a change and potentially what you do next is about social causes, I think that very much is aligned with that answer. And it's interesting, Ishveen, because when I'm speaking with, you know, people who have perceived to be incredibly successful through whether it's in sport and business and theatre or film or whatever industry they might be working in, I always have this kind of caveat or this question I'd ask at the end of the show. And it's more to do with, has there been a price to your success?
Has there been a price to my success? Yeah, I'd say I don't think there's been a price to my success. I think there's been a price to my drive. And, you know, my desire to prioritize work over, you know, potentially like growing a family or starting a family or, you know, being in America versus like being at home in England where my parents are. But I don't think it's for the success. I think it's for the decisions I wanted to make. And you know, therefore no regrets.
Yeah, it is interesting because I when I do ask that question, probably that is the one thing that comes up in it. And it's much more to do with the people, the relationships, you know, it's not the professional side in terms of price to your success. It's more to do with how some things have kind of gone by the wayside. So, you know, it really is such a difficult question because it probably goes back to that almost perennial question that we all have is, can you have it all? And ultimately, I don't think you can have it all at the same time, but possibly you could have it all at different periods in your life. And my final question for you, Ishveen, because this has been so interesting for me to try and understand, you know, the mindset of someone who's been incredibly successful for you and the fact that you come into this industry so much later, it wasn't even something you studied, and yet you've gone and been remarkably successful. So at this stage in your life, and I'm not going to ask your age, but you're definitely a lot younger than I am at 43. What is your definition of success going forward in your life?
Going forward, it's funny because when you first said it at the beginning, it's like you're almost two years up for an evolution in 1 hour. It's brilliant, Paul. So obviously at the beginning I said happiness, but that's like very, I'm like, can I change that answer? I think, you know, before it was like happiness and that was like very intrinsic. But like, I would say for me, when I go forward and think about success and what I really want, I'd say it's about like putting out, like making change in the world. And, you know, sometimes, especially like if I have a bad day and I'm sitting there and I think, okay, well, you know, it's pretty sick that like there are people who are hopefully enjoying their work and who have a salary and health insurance and everything else from a company that I started. Like I literally am like providing for them in a way. I mean, obviously they could do other jobs as well, but like, and I think that's like really empowering. And then obviously like the athletes that like get paid, you know, I remember we had this lacrosse player who was like I can play lacrosse full time because open sponsorship like literally takes care of us. So that was like pretty empowering. But I would say like success is the ability to create positive change for others. And, you know, I hope we can do that at like such a huge scale.
Adrian and Anne, thank you very much for your time. I really, really enjoyed that.
Thanks, Paul. So did I. Challenging questions on a Monday morning, but loved it.
Well, what an incredibly impressive young woman. For someone who's on the Forbes 30 under 30 sports list, as well as the top 100 female founders list, Aisvin Anand is just so impressive in everything she does. Talking about being the captain of the netball and cricket teams at Oxford University, all the way through to going to India whenever she's 24, there's just so many things that she just did naturally, push herself out of her comfort zone, tried new challenges, and succeeded time and time again. And now that Open Sponsorship is turning over multi-millions every single year and working with the 1,000 of the best athletes in the world, I think it's just a credit to just how amazing Aisvin Anand is. I really hope you enjoyed that. I hope if you're listening to this, that you saw some of the barriers that Aisvin is going through and completely knocked down. And if they apply in your life, then maybe you can do the same. And hopefully you can join us for another episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you for everyone involved in making today's show. From producing, we've got Moment Digital with Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor. Dave Webster has been our researcher. And Emily Drake helps get us out all of our social media posts on the psychology of success.